Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. And of course, it's Tuesday. Welcome to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and our environment. Produced right here at WEAA in Baltimore, at WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community, and also broadcast on the Marvel Public Radio on WSTL 90.7 FM. And we begin our program today to talk about a report that came out on the state of diversity in environmental organizations that was written by Dr. Dorsetta Taylor and Whitney Perkin from a blogger at thinkabouteat.com wrote a piece about this as well. So we're going to wrestle with this question of why there are so few African Americans, at least seemingly in the environmental movement, but in the leadership of the movement and as part of the environmental struggle in this country. That's how it visually seems, and by some of the research done by Dorsetta Taylor, it seems to be that way. So we're joined here by Dr. Dorsetta Taylor, who is Professor, Environmental Justice Field of Studies Coordinator, past Chair of Environment and Technology Section of the American Sociological Association at the University of Michigan, and author of the report we're discussing, and also Toxic Communities, Environmental Racism, Industrial Pollution, and Residential Mobility. And Dr. Taylor, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I hope you're having a wonderful day.
I am having a good day. We start off our program today talking about John Coltrane and Love Supreme. What could be so bad? We are also here with Whitney Pitkin, who is writer on food, agriculture, and environment for the Bay Journal and a fellow at the Institute of Journalists of Natural Resources and a blogger at thinkabouteat.com. And good to have you with us, Whitney. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Jackie Patterson is joining us. She is calling us from a conference in Peru, but she is director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative. Jackie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Always good to
have you. Always great to have you with us. I know you couldn't drive across town today. It'd be a little bit of a long trip.
Yeah, definitely.
And Fred Tupman is in the studio. Fred Tupman is a Patuxent Water River Keeper. And welcome to the studio, Fred. Good to have you here.
Great.
And one of the things I said to Fred, well, you're the only African-American water keeper in Maryland. He said, no, I'm the only African-American water keeper in the United States. So that says volumes about part of what we're talking about here. And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Dr. Dorsetta Taylor, let me start with you and just talk about, let's describe this report, because you looked at the United States government, agencies, NGOs, foundations, to see the breadth or in lack of depth in some ways of interns and people working there and leadership, correct?
Yes. Yes. So it was a national study, and I sought to do a comprehensive set of analysis that could give us a sense across a number of types of organizations of how much diversity there was and whether or not it was improving over time. And so if we look back at the 1990s, we do see some improvement. But if we look at where we are today, then one would really expect to see a greater trajectory of having more people of color in these organizations, and not just being hired, but as you move up the occupational ranks, to see more in leadership in these organizations. And we're just not seeing those numbers showing up. So it really is cause for concern.
Now, if you can please correct me if I misread or misinterpreted some of the data and some of the what you described in this report, but it seemed to be saying, at least in some of the what the organizations themselves had to say, is that yes, by a large margin they were concerned on many levels about the issue of diversity and bringing more people of color in, but in terms of the of what to do, it wasn't a priority item on their agendas. Is that fair to say?
Well, if it is a priority, they're going about it, in many cases, the wrong way. So they have been saying for a long time, even when I was a student back in the 90s, all these organizations would say, yes, we're concerned. We want to see more students of color going through environmental programs, and we want to be able to find them and hire them. That's always been the mantra. However, when you do look at the data, they aren't hiring the students. they are making hires, because virtually over 90% of the organizations I survey said, yes, we've hired someone in the last 3 years. When you ask, who have you hired, they're not hiring people of color. So they're not doing what they are saying they want to do. They also are not recruiting very well. So, for instance, there are many conferences that go on each year. For instance, a conference run by Manners, Minorities in Agriculture and Natural Resources. If you go to that conference, you'll find about 400 or so of the brightest African-American students who are doing their degrees in the fields of agriculture and natural resources and environment. You'll not find any environmental organization there recruiting. If you go to SACNAS, if you go to NHEC, these are Hispanic conferences, similar conferences, you will not find the environmental organizations there. If you go to the Native American equivalent, you just don't see them there. Who do you see there? You see Cargill, you see Monsanto, you see Weyerhaeuser. So the big corporate organizations that do environment as part of their portfolio, they know how to go and recruit and find talent. The big enviros don't put any budgetary line items in their budget to do recruiting, to do to hire diversity managers, to do staff development, to do training, and so they're just not putting the money in the places that it needs to go so that they can attract, recruit, and retain minority talent.
And I think this is, there's so many pieces to parse out here, but let me just pick up on what you just said, Dorcita, which is that where the environmental groups do not go in terms of these conferences and going out there. And this is not the first time we have kind of studied and looked at on this program this gap here, where the groups that most environmental groups lobby and fight against for a clean environment and environmental justice and environmental issues are the very groups that go to the Black environmental organizations and the Congressional Black Caucus and lobby there hard. To recruit people, and this is glaring on so many levels, and let me go around the room and get your thoughts on this, and let me go to Jackie, who's joining us from Peru, and then go to Fatup, and then go over to Whitney. Jackie,
sure, So I think that I am seeing a lot of the. Can you hear me? Okay, I hear.
Yes, we can hear you. I can hear you.
Okay, good. So, a lot of what Dr. Taylor has said is as issues around the systemic lack of emphasis on bringing on folks. I see it on the other side in terms of how that plays out in terms of the environment of, no pun intended, of the various organizations and in terms of the organizing that we see and also the very results that you talk about with regard to folks trying to get folks on board in terms of their issues. So whether it's the rooms that I go into, like recently I was at a conference on organizing in the Southeast, which is where the highest concentration of African-Americans are around coal plants. And again, those coal plants are disproportionately located in communities of color. And I'm at this conference of maybe 50 people. That was a strategy session on organizing, and I'm the only African-American person in the room. And so, and it's not an uncommon situation of being the only African-American person or the only person of color in rooms where strategies are being built and so forth. So, and then on the other side, when engaging with, right now we're trying to deal with issues around distributed generation of solar, and we've seen where these different coal companies and oil and gas companies and so forth have built long-term relationships with these groups. And then the big greens come in just at the very moment that they need help on something, and they don't have the relationship. They don't really understand the culture and so forth. And so there's no fertile ground upon which to even hear the arguments that they're giving on the other side.
Good.
I could go on and on, but I'll pause.
That's okay. go ahead.
Well, I think we're actually overthinking this.
What do you mean?
A lot of these environmental organizations are very unappealing places for people of color to work. They're not just environmental organizations. They're social organizations, too. And the internal cultures of these places requires that you check your diversity at the door. What they want is to recruit people of color who think and act and have the same values as white environmentalists. And that's very tough. I mean, speaking as someone who works in a predominantly white environmental community, I'm seen as impertinent if I share ideas or views or values that are not consistent with my white counterparts. So the way to get diversity is not to hire it, right? It's magnetic. Diversity is magnetic. If you're doing work that serves communities of color, if you're doing work that substantially benefits the constituency that you want to attract. Some of those corporations you mentioned are financiers of some of the largest environmental organizations that on the planet. And, you know, these groups work on behalf of their donors and their supporters, and sometimes those interests are adverse to communities of color. So it's very unappealing to work in an environmental organization where you're assured to be doing work that doesn't benefit the general society, but is self-serving for those organizations that have a common worldview, a common social framework. I mean, that's just my take on it, is that they're unappealing. But why would I want to work in a place that doesn't work on the problems of communities of color, that doesn't care? You don't get diversity unless you do EJ, environmental justice. They go together. You can't have one without the other.
So, you know, Whitney Pipkin,
sure.
You cover this in the state of Maryland, especially in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And so I'm curious, when you first saw this report and you witnessed what goes on in the mostly white world of environmental movement in this Chesapeake Bay watershed, do these conversations ever take place?
Yeah, I mean, we've been having them on our staff at the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and I think it's funny, when I started making calls about this report to get reactions, everyone said, well, yeah, we already knew that. And they had stories like what was said about being the only person of color in a conference room setting. And so that is something that we see throughout our watershed. It's particularly acute here in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, because we do have diversity in some of the urban areas that are struggling with water quality, like Baltimore, D.C., Virginia Beach, and that diversity is not being represented in the larger organizations. We are beginning to see some of the smaller grassroots organizations approach these environmental issues from the community level, and that's being successful in the Anacostia watershed. For example, you have Dennis Chestnut with Groundwork Anacostia, who's really engaging the local communities. In Prince George's County, Maryland, you have I have a story in the next issue about their program to engage churches in stormwater retention projects. And so there's some creative methods kind of bubbling up from the ground level, but there is often a disconnect in these communities. They don't really connect to the health of a crab out in the Chesapeake Bay. The issues where they're being engaged successfully are flooding in their neighborhoods, water quality, the health of fish that they're fishing and sharing with their families out of the rivers.
Go ahead, Fred.
So here's the irony, right? The grassroots organizations that you're describing, Whitney, are in fact already integrated. They're already diverse. Grassroots groups aren't doing the same mm-hmm. work that big, massive environmental organizations are doing. So the irony is that these big environmental organizations are trying to preach to the grassroots about diversity when the diversity is already there. It's already in
right.
the grassroots. So the problem is internal, right? It's internal in these environmental movements. It's not because the job postings aren't being put in all the right places, right? The problem is that they are very well, very poorly poised for diversity, not ready for it. They're not eager to embrace it.
Well, and that's what you just said. You just said, I'm eager to embrace it. And Dr. Rosetta Taylor, I mean, I think that, you know, with all that we're addressing here in the United States right now around issues of race that are just exploding, which and rightly so exploding and kind of in this kind of after the 1960s, we're now seeing the 2010s and 14s exploding on the scene and wrestling these questions. But when it's not even in their framework, where do we go from this? I mean, I think you can only have, I saw part of the report where people are having diversity workshops, but diversity workshops only go so far. It has to do with what is in the internal life of that organization and how it defines itself.
I think what Fred is pointing out and what Dr. Taylor teases out in her report is that the issue is really money. So the bigger environmental organizations have larger pots of money. And so even if the grassroots groups are good at mobilizing volunteers to do trash cleanup, you're not going to see the giant shift that are needed in environmental justice respect without the bigger organizations prioritizing these things financially.
Well, big money, okay, doesn't seek social and economic change. right? Big money that finances these big organizations, they would lose that money if they were working on the empowerment of local communities of color, right? So they keep those issues very separate. They just want the trash picked up. They don't want to change the whole social economic scene. They don't want to change the leadership. That's revolutionary. These big groups don't do revolutionary work. They do anti-pollution work. It's different.
Rosetta Taylor, jump in before we go to Jackie Patterson. I mean, just...
Yes. It's certainly really about the internal structure. And these internal structures, as I've said to people for a long time, they have taken 150 years to build them. Because many of these organizations that we're talking about date back to the 1880s, 1890s. So they've had quite a lot of time to put these structures in place and to protect these structures within their leadership. So it is not surprising that they do not want those transformational kinds of questions and those voices in the organization. The reality of it, though, is people of color we're at a point where we cannot afford to say we are not going to do environment, because if you look at most of the environmental disasters, hazards, they disproportionately affect and black communities more than any other communities. That's part of what I chronicle in Toxic Communities, just how insidious the impacts are on us. So we can't necessarily walk away and say we're not going to engage these communities. The challenge for us is how we're going to do it and be in charge of that discourse to be a part of that leadership discussion. Someone mentioned earlier about the stakeholder processes where you go into these rooms and you're the only black person or the only person of color. That's going to probably shift the needle very little or not at all. We need the millennial generation of students of color coming up behind us. And it really is a different generation. If you look at kids in their teens and early 20s, you'll find black kids doing amazing environmental work that their parents and their grandparents weren't involved in, because they understand how critical it is for them to get engaged in things like climate adaptation. There are young black kids running around Detroit, setting up climate adaptation plans in their communities. You wouldn't have seen that a decade ago, because those kids understand how critical it is to be engaged on community environmental issues. So we do have quite a bit of a big challenge, both from the people of color end in terms of understanding where the discourses are going and how shifts are going and how to be more critical players on environmental justice, but on a broader range of issues.
Now, you're seeing it all. You're seeing it here out of Maryland as well, around the incinerator issue on the east side of Baltimore, where young people are taking the lead, actually opposing their parents in fighting this incinerator be built and building a whole movement around what happens to our trash into communities. And that maybe is where the energy will come from. And Jackie, so I'm curious what we all think about where this future might go. I mean, where is this going to take us? Because you, if there's a major disconnect between white and communities of color in this environmental movement, from national groups to local groups, if there is this kind of wedge going in many ways with some of the biggest polluters in the country and biggest environmental businesses have caused so much of the environmental problem, are funding a lot of these groups, as well as being a major stakeholder and where most groups of color meet, including the Black Congressional Caucus, then this is a situation that is very volatile, it seems to me, Jackie.
Yes. So I do want to bring a little, I want to second what was just said in terms of
the
youth and the hope we find there. And then secondly, I want to just bring a little bit of hope in terms of an initiative that that I'm a part of and that others are engaged in called the Building Equity and Alignment Initiative. And it's actually a very intentional process that brings together foundations, grassroots, frontline community groups, and big green to actually talk about. And there's a structure around shifting hearts, shifting minds, and shifting cultures of practice. And the whole aim is to actually shift resources to frontline grassroots groups and to really, and to at the same time talk about the principles of organizing together with big green organizations and what it really means to actually centralize the principles and practices of frontline groups who should be leading in this struggle, and really also having a conversation directly with philanthropy about how they're to some extent responsible for the dynamic that's evolved in terms of this being the white-led environmental face of environmentalism, and really shifting how we're thinking about it and how we're actually doing it. So it's been going for about a year now, and is moving forward in terms of really having some deep conversations and with leadership of these different entities about their responsibility and how we can actually make this shift. So let's bring that up. And it actually was spearheaded by the Overbrook Foundation, interestingly enough, because they saw what was happening. Some of the other foundations who are involved include some of the bigger foundations like Cresty and Hewlett, as well as some others. And then Greenpeace is involved, as well as the Sierra Club, NRDC is there, and a number of grassroots online community groups.
But you were about to say what?
Well, I think we're all on the same page, maybe just different parts of the same page. I think we're talking about two different things, really, here. One is diversity, which is the who. Who's doing the work? And that's an easy problem to solve. Let's just go out and hire some people of color. Big deal. What we haven't solved, the what. EJ is the what. Environmental justice is what these groups are working on in substance that provides benefit to the communities they serve. They don't serve black communities, brown communities. They don't. There's no incentive for them to do so because the monetary resources flow, right, from large corporate interests in some cases, or moneyed interests that, again, don't have a social agenda beyond picking up the trash and cleaning up the planet in a general sense.
Can I ask you to define what you're saying a bit more so we can wrestle with this? What you're
sure.
saying? What are these two different agendas you're talking about exactly?
Yeah.
You use the word anti-pollution, but what specifically are you talking about?
Talking about diversity on one side of the plank, which is what is the makeup of the workforce? Okay. On the other end of the spectrum is what the workforce is working on. If the workforce in the environmental community is working on where the worst problems are, I assure you they would be working on environmental justice problems, because national studies show that's where the worst problems are, right? But they're not doing that, least of all in the Bay Movement, right, which largely is about preserving beautiful
right.
areas, saving crabs and oysters, but rarely picks up a problem for, a subjugated community, a disenfranchised community. And I believe if they did, or let me flip it the other way, if you diversified the leadership of these organizations, does anybody doubt they'd be doing different priorities? They'd be working on very different problems. And that creates resentment within a predominantly white community that's okay with the agenda. They just want more black and brown people on their page, on their bandwagon.
All right, so let me take that where this is, and let me just pick one very specific thing. Maybe think of this. Maybe it's not related. You will say, oh, no, that's not what I mean, but maybe let me throw it out there for the four of you to talk about. In the state of Maryland, where we broadcast from, there is an argument going on around this thing called the phosphorus management tool, which has to do with runoff from our farms into the bay and destroying the water and having farmers to manage the amount of phosphorus, and so you can judge the levels that are on there to say, yes, you can put this on your land. No, you can't put this on your land. And farmers in Upper are saying no, and environmentalists are pushing and saying yes, Chesapeake Bay Foundation and the rest. And so when you see those hearings take place and you see these conversations take place around those issues, those are almost entirely made up of people who are white on one side or the other. So I want to talk about, because that's one of the motivating factors in this area. And it's, yes, this has to do with the oysters, has to do with the crabs, has to do with the state of the bay and our water, but it also has to do with the state of people's lives, right? So we have to take a break here, is that what we're doing? So
the programming, the Bay program's priorities are oriented around nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment. So that's the symptom that you're seeing there is that it's just a matter of measuring how you can move that needle in the largest way, which is how you get phosphorus tools and farmers versus the Bay kind of issues. Whereas the needle that Fred's talking about moving is a diversity one, and there's just a disconnect. I don't know where the connection is. We at the Chesapeake Bay watershed has long been about the fish and the crabs and the oysters and reviving them, and it's just beginning to sort of wake up to the impacts in the local communities.
So we have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back. I want to pick up on that point and talk about, because to me this is like a concrete example and that we can talk about that is emanating from where this program is being broadcast from, that I think we can figure out. So what would that mean to create a diversity around these issues? Is it possible? And what issues are missing in this that creates the diversity? We'll be right back. Stay with us as we look at the lack of diversity in our environmental movements. Stay with us. We'll be right back.